So we've been exploring the White Lotus Sutra, which really can be best related to as a series of stories and parables of a legendary and mythic nature. Better related to really as poetry or a play even, which particularly if you ever go and see a play or listen to a poem, communicates when it's really good, communicates more directly towards the imagination and the to the emotional dimension of our beings. So we're really, when we're considering the parables of the White Lotus Sutra, this we're really trying to connect with the teachings of the Buddha, not in this sense, not as literal facts, but more as symbolic truths. We're trying to relate, or we're invited to relate to what's being said symbolically rather than literally. So you do get these tales of vistas of thousands of bodhisattvas across universes, all sitting atop diamond lotus thrones that are several thousand stories high, and by the power of his imagination, the Buddha magically transported all beings from all corners of the universe, and all were, you know, present at the teaching. This sounds a little bit like science fiction, maybe a little bit unbelievable, but what there's always something communicated which has relevance to understanding the Dharma in its principial way rather than a literal way. So with the sort of universal scale that the Lotus Sutra is set within, we have an emphasis on the universal nature of the Dharma, the universality of the teachings, the principial nature of the teachings. In a certain way, a way that they cannot really be grasped or nailed down. If you think you've understood the Dharma, you think you've got an angle on it, well, usually we're wrong. What the White Lotus Sutra encourages or brings forth is a sense of openness, a sense of connection with a deeper sense in the being, a sense of the imaginal, a sense of bringing forth faith even, confidence, trust in a path that's really drawn out by the imagination. And if it's speaking to our emotional dimension of being, it's bringing more of ourselves, bringing more of our energy behind our practice. I read a poem before the meditation, and really the poem very much reflects some of the themes I want to cover tonight in terms of the world being too much with us. But before we go on to that, I want to just bring us back to a parable we covered a little while ago, but I didn't feel we'd quite done with. And that's the parable of the burning house, which I'll just very briefly summarize, and then we'll just explore some dimensions of one part of it. So the parable of the burning house is set in the scene of there are children in this house, this very old rickety cobwebby, ghost-filled house, and they're all running around playing their games with their toys and their, each other, chasing each other around, getting all the, but suddenly the house catches fire. Okay, it's an old dry tinderbox of a house, and it suddenly erupts in flames. The children are unaware of this. The children are unaware of this, and they don't perceive the danger. They don't perceive the danger. And there's the father of the children, an old man, is outside the house and sees the house erupt into flame and starts calling the children. He considers going in and rescuing them one by one, but realizes that he won't be able to save all of them if he tries to save them one by one. So he just calls them out. But initially they don't listen. So he then starts tempting them out with different types of carts, goat carts, ox carts, which I understand in the time were the sort of really good way of travelling. And the children are really captivated by the promise of these wonderful carts to ride in and start rushing out of the house, falling in, pushing each other out of the way to get to their carts. And then they ask the old man to deliver on his promises. And actually, he delivers more than he's promised them. He doesn't just deliver goat's carts to those he's promised goat carts. He delivers them all the best kind of carts. Okay? So that's the story in a nutshell. That's the parable of the burning house, a very abridged version. And the particular aspects of it that I wanted to draw out is this nature of the call, the sort of meaning of the old man calling the children. So firstly, the children in the house is, unsurprisingly, us. Yes, the children are basically representing us, running around the world, getting involved in what we get involved in, getting really not paying attention to the imminent dangers in our lives, maybe not paying attention to life even, the sort of rapid passage of life, how short life is, and how much we get involved and sidetracked by things that we get involved with in life, and not really focused on what's most important for the development of ourselves as human beings, maybe. And the old man, the father, represents the Buddha. And the Buddha calling. So what do we think the old man's call represents? Do we have any sense of that?
Teachings,
yes. Yes, absolutely. So the teachings of the Dharma. In a certain way, that whole episode of him promising the children things is what's known as skillful means. He makes a proposal, a tempting proposal, which gets the children really interested. But he doesn't just give them what he promised them, he gives them much more. And in a certain sense, I think that's a very important thing. That's a very important distinction to make, really, in that we don't know the riches that are potentially available to us unless we sort of walk the path. We can't really know. We can only sort of really respond to that which is tempting us now. That's what we're interested in now. So it might be that we're interested in worldly success and wealth and what, and that's what our energy is getting behind. Yeah? The idea of stillness, simplicity and contentment might not be so exciting or even attractive. So it's worthwhile giving some, and this is particularly what I wanted to focus on tonight, was what is it that we are called to? There's this piece around what calls us into the center. Yeah? What called us to Buddhism? What brought us here? What was it that brought us here? What got us through the door? That's the question. For reflection.
When you're talking, it made me think of how much when I first went on retreat, I thought, this is going to be so good for my cricket. You know, sort of in and out of form with sports, and the experience of meditating on retreat was so much like being in form. In batting particularly, you know, I thought, oh, this is so good for batting, you know, I thought, a couple of years before I realised that, well actually, a couple of years later I just gave up on it altogether. I thought it was for that, but actually made me just think, I don't even need to do this anymore. So it's really strange, but that's what it made me think of when you're saying you end up with, I thought I was getting that, and it ended up just getting something completely different, actually.
Does anybody else have an experience like that?
Exactly the same.
Cricket.
Theatre, I work with actors, and I feel like I felt like it would be a helpful thing to be more like calm and present and receptive, and it is. But that stopped being the point of it.
So what is it that keeps us going? What is it that keeps us coming back through the door, that keeps us engaging with practice?
Learning.
Yes. Can you say more about learning?
Well, learning about yourself. Learning about paradox. Being in a room with a like-minded person.
So that sense of fellow feeling, that sense of striving together, maybe that sense of, in some ways I came for the atmosphere. There was a certain atmosphere, maybe a certain friendliness. So it's very difficult to put the finger on, really, isn't it? There's just a certain feeling about the place, this place, or a retreat centre.
For me, it's like acceptance. Like, I don't feel, well, like, you know, quite ugly feelings, but I like coming back to practice because I know I can start where I am. I really want to get rid of these feelings, but I just know I have to accept it, and by practice I can accept it, so I can go somewhere.
Absolutely.
Meditation is going home for me. I return to where I belong. And I was motivated to meditate originally to calm the restless, turbulent mind, to find inner peace. And then after a while I realised, even if you don't feel you're finding it, you keep meditating and that's it.
You just keep turning up.
You just keep turning up and doing it, and that's it. You know, I stopped analysing what was the benefit, what was I getting out of it. I just have to do it.
Right.
You have to go to the toilet, you have to meditate. Get my point.
So there's the call of the cushion and the call of nature.
Just for that metaphor. Yes.
Any other sense of what draws you in?
Faith towards the idea that you want to be like Buddha. condition
yeah.
where everyone want to be same like you are, at least they inspire by that goal. They feel it. You get the energy at that place, like with the center. You won't get that in city center.
Sure. Sometimes London can call, can't
yes.
it? London calling. So there's that sense of confidence that arises, that we're on the right track, as it were, on a helpful path somehow. We're not quite sure where it leads or what it involves, but it feels okay now. It feels the sort of right thing to be doing.
Yeah.
It's not always clear what it's delivering or how it's working, but it just seems to work. And the reason I'm asking this question is because it's all too easy for us to not really clock that, not really notice that. Not really notice the benefits of coming to the Buddhist Center or practicing regularly. And I just encourage us, because it's an extremely important practice, just to notice the benefits. Because it's a really helpful way of sustaining a regular practice in a world that's pulling us in the opposite direction. What is it that pulls us away? Maybe some of us have, you know, come along for a little while and then we get called away. Maybe it's sort of things are going well for a while and then something else takes over, takes our attention and energy for a while. What is it that pulls us away? What calls us away from the center or our practice?
Not to pay attention.
Uh-huh.
I'd probably say when things start, when things are good, when things are really good, when everything's kind of going well, then there's not. Why do I need to meditate during those periods when everything kind of seems alright?
Sure. And that can be quite a challenge in a practice where, you know, maybe we become a little bit more aware, maybe we become more emotionally positive, and life doesn't sort of left field us very often. It feels like we're in the flow with life a little bit, and we can take our foot off the gas with our practice and end up gradually the sort of life starts to drain out of it. We perhaps and then what happens?
Suffering returns.
Yeah. Yes. It's not just me, is it?
There's something there about the relationship with suffering and the relationship with happiness, isn't there? Because my kind of understanding is that I'm supposed to be kind of like not indifferent to either of them, but they're both just. Well, it's just happiness, it's suffering, it's whatever. I mean, I'm not explaining this very clearly, but
sure.
I don't think we need to be drawn to either of them.
Well, perhaps...
It's the same, in a funny sort of way. Yeah. Something.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense?
I think I know what you mean. Are you saying that that they're both experiences that are simply arising?
Yeah, and we're attracted to one and we're repelled by the other.
Indeed.
We should be neither attracted nor repelled in the meditative state.
Yeah, but we can be in some instances, can't we? Yeah. Sal, you were going to say something.
Just struck by what the other person with the nice shirt said about stopping meditating when you're happy. And I remember I experienced a few years ago where I went on retreat, on a summer retreat. And for many years I've been in the winter or the spring retreat. And so I was supposed to be in the summer. And I remember And it was the first time ever I was really pissed off going on retreat. Because it was the summer and I was having a really good time. I was having a great time. And I had to stop having my great time in order to go on retreat. And I was in a really bad mood for retreat. And I remember thinking, this is the retreat where I get to test this practice as not just this kind of ancient and sophisticated form of therapy that will get me happy and then I've made it. And I remember people saying, and I know this, so in relation to, you know, you get drawn out with one promise, and it opens up into this huge new vista you weren't expecting. So, and that's really what happened, because I remember thinking, okay, what is this practice if it's not just therapy? I'm already happy, I'm having a lovely time. And people, I've heard it said about practice where we'll do the mindfulness breathing and the mess bath in order to kind of become positive and integrated. So when you become a happy, healthy human being, then you're ready to start. Then you're ready for this whole new other thing to open up. So this kind of, it's almost like this kind of, this the mindfulness, the section of mindfulness promise of happiness. Once you get there, that's it, you kind of made it. But actually, I found on that retreat, eventually so much more than I could possibly have anticipated. And I can't quite explain what happened, but it was the retreat at which I understood that this practice is not something to just make you happy. It's not just a sophisticated form of therapy, and that's the end. In fact, it's the beginning of this whole, but you have to, I think, of course, if we're in some kind of pain, the first thing you want to do is get out the pain, alleviate that pain. But when you do, and I think that does emerge, like, I think my emotional tone has risen throughout my year of practice. And I found as I do, it's a bit like I can see this further horizon that I couldn't see before.
Well, thank you for that. That's very well put. So important to notice the benefits, and we perhaps only see the benefits of practice over time. It's also important to use the things that pull us away, to really recognize them. And I was just reflecting over the weekend of some particular calls that we regularly get caught up in, or we particularly get pulled away by, or that go between us and our practice. Does anybody get the call to work?
Yes.
The call to work.
Yeah.
Now that call to work, which where we have that slightly restless feeling that we must get up and get on. Yeah. We must get up. We get in early, have that cup of coffee, or whatever our early morning beverage is, and we can get that few minutes peace to get something done before the day starts. Yeah. So we've got that pull into activity, that pull into work. And particularly if, I work as a nurse, and there's a particular culture in nursing whereby you're a good nurse if you're busy. Yeah? You're a good nurse if you get lots of done and don't show any sweat. But this can be reflected in other employment, and you can say, I've done well today if I've got this list of tasks done. Yes? And oftentimes we can get really, really very involved in work and really irritated when somebody's in the way of our task list. Yeah? Or somebody who's we're expecting to have achieved a certain level of tasks doesn't deliver them, maybe. So maybe it's a call to work that gets in the way, and we're sort of working late, getting up early, and where's the time for meditation? I'll do it later, or I'll do it before I get to bed and we're too tired by the time we get home. Does anybody have that experience? Yeah. So how do we work with that? How do we actually think about bringing ourselves more and more into work and using the activity of work for our spiritual development? Have we any ideas about that? How do we work with the call to work?
You can treat your spiritual life as work.
Mm-hmm. Can you say more?
Well, I think that's a bit to do with the call of call away from practice.
Mm.
You prioritize these things such as work or the next study or whatever you're doing.
Mm.
When you choose really to prioritize what we do here.
Yeah. Is there anything we can do in work? So in the Buddhist tradition, we have the principle of right livelihood, yes, where very much the idea is that work is a context for spiritual practice. Now, very few of us will have the opportunity of that. But there are some principles that right livelihood rests on that perhaps we can see as bringing more and more into life in our daily work. Yeah? So it might be having a sense of ethical practice within work. Yeah? And it may be that we don't have a job which is obviously immediately ethical. It may be, I'm not going to start naming jobs that may be more or less ethical. But it might be that we can reference ourselves in relation to the ethical precepts in terms of speech, in terms of conduct with our fellow work persons, yes? So that we enable ourselves to have a continuity of practice. When we're in the grip of the call to work.
Of his gossip, you can make a conscious effort to separate yourself from that.
Yes.
Not get involved in it.
Exactly.
Being mindful in the workplace.
Yes, absolutely. So that's
it's
a really.
Speech.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's, you know, perhaps there's a new directive that's come in that means there's substantial change. And you know how we love change, and particularly when we have to work radically differently, yeah? And the temptation can be to, well, firstly, critique all the holes in it. And there's a different thing from critiquing all the holes in something to actually positively engaging with what will make it work better, yeah? Or perhaps what needs to change. Sometimes it isn't a negotiation. Sometimes we have to practice the wisdom of no escape, yeah? But sometimes, you know, the tendency can be to go into a sense of a group mindset where we all sort of start saying what's wrong with the new project. Yeah? So we could perhaps be in that situation a slightly more positive influence about, the sort of the voice that balances the equation. So this is what we are given to do. This is what we've got to achieve, but how can we do that in the most helpful way possible that works for us and works for the project? Yeah? How can we, in a certain sense, how can we be more solution-focused in the work sense? But resist the temptation to bias towards the critique. Yeah? Does that make sense? Can we be the positive voice? And I don't mean just happy clapping. I mean the person who balances the equation. And in a certain sense, if we look at what we do when we get into a negative critical mental state, firstly, it's deeply unpleasant for us. It sort of creates an unpleasant atmosphere. and it often isn't productive of anything. Sometimes we need to work through we sort of need to honour the emotions a little bit, but then we sort of need to be bigger than that. We could potentially be bigger and see things in the round. I found this particularly with a lot of the changes in the NHS, whereby, you know, we might be working with less staff, for example. Yeah, we might be working with less staff. We might have more to do, okay? But then, if we don't work as a team, and if we're all looking at that person's workload being lighter than mine, rather than negotiating parity of our workload, and helping each other, the whole team comes apart. But if we can really be focused on the how can we all get through this together, suddenly things start to work. Suddenly things just start working. And some of the best days I've had in practice as a nurse is when we've been awfully short-staffed, but we've put down all the divisions and we've just come together and worked for it. Yeah. I think one of the remarkable examples of that was 7-7 at the Royal London Hospital, where we saw 400 patients in 3 hours. And it was actually the hospital just flowed. It flowed. I mean, everybody just came in and helped. And nobody was like, but I haven't had a break, or I'm meant to be leaving at this time, or I've got this meeting to get to. We just all put it all down and just focused on what was needed right in front of us. Yeah. Another possibility is we can just look at the sometimes the enormity of our task list can be really sort of all around us. Yeah, we can surround ourselves with the sort of restlessness of our activity. And maybe sometimes it's just about deciding what I'm doing next, and then what I'm doing after that, and then what I'm doing after that. And we only need to sort of go into the future a little way. And it allows us then to continually meet the changing priorities that sometimes arise through the day. And so we have a sense of purpose, but we also have a sense of staying with the one thing that we're doing now. Yeah? So perhaps we can bring that sort of sense of continuity of mindfulness as well into work. Yeah.
Can I ask a question about, in the example that you gave about, say you're at work and if you're understaffed and everyone pulls together and works harder to get the tasks done, That involves a level of sacrifice, and also, I mean, if your boss hasn't put enough people to work, and your kind of working standards have been reduced because of that, in that example that you gave, you're giving into that, and letting your employer put less people to work, and you will all pick up the slack and work harder. I can think of it because I've been thinking about that in a sense. Like my housemate, he just will leave kind of washing up, lying around. And I have a principle that I'm not going to clean up kind of someone else's washing up. I don't want to just fall into that trap of being a woman and cleaning up after them. But then that emerges as a kind of point of conflict, because I don't want to compromise kind of my principle on that, in the same way that you might not want to compromise your principle and the fact that you deserve to have so many breaks in a working day or whatever. So how might you reconcile that?
So in the washing up example, can we get into communication about that? Because often we're making assumptions about each other and roles and things like that, but can we actually get into communication around maybe there's a way of organising to give clearer responsibilities in a particular situation? Maybe it's like, you know, is there something that he's running off to do? Sometimes it's about just opening up the communication, and say, and if we do that, but not with a sense of what I need you to do is, but how are we going to manage the house? How are we going to manage the kitchen? What is it that we need to do? What do you need in relation to kitchen? What do I need in relation to kitchen? Can we come to some agreement and build a consensus around how it should be managed? So perhaps we can do something around that. Yeah?
And if, I mean, say that kind of has been tried.
Uh-huh.
Kind of ongoing. And say also maybe like your boss, the way you're not working up example, but your boss kind of doesn't respect kind of the fact that you have certain rights kind of in the workplace.
Mm.
Once you've got to that point, if you've spent kind of time trying kind of communicating, being open about all of that stuff, is it then that you have to kind of extract yourself from a situation?
So, I mean, some situations you immediately can't do anything. You might have the right staffing levels, but then three people go off sick and it's not possible to replace them. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's important to clarify the particulars of a situation that that are at work. It might be that we're working with less staff temporarily. It might be as an ongoing thing, and it might be that there needs to be some more measurement to match the workload to the dependency, as it were. I don't want to go too deeply into that because we won't work out particular individual problems within the context of the class, but happy to talk about it afterwards. There's quite a lot of ground to cover, and I realise we've got about 15 minutes. So, and so I just wanted to see if we could do a little bit more on this notion of how do we work more creatively in the work situation. So can we be say, if we're bringing more ethical awareness into work, if we're bringing a greater sense of cooperation, if we're bringing in a sense of awareness of others, can we bring more positive emotion into the work? Is there a role for metta that we can bring more alive into the process of work? So it might be as simple as making somebody a cup of tea, but it might also be noticing when somebody does something well, yeah, and really, really noticing it, really, really noticing it, and saying it to them. Yeah? But not just saying, I thought you did that really well, but being specific and being really, really clear. And likewise, sometimes it's necessary to kindly and with awareness point out when things aren't going well. And to just really say, with awareness of the other person, at an appropriate time and place, what is it that's difficult, and why that is? So it was interesting what you did there. Why did you decide to do it in that way? Yeah. So that's not a passive aggressive statement, but it's something that's trying to open up communication in a way that's not as confrontational. Yes. It allows the other person to be more aware of what they're doing, but at the same time shows your interest in them and to communicate the understanding of what was happening and why it was happening in that way. So maybe we could bring a more metaphor sense of communication into recognizing and rejoicing when things are going well and really seeing people, and at the same time really, really making sure that we don't just, you know, be a Buddhist doormat, but we're part of making the process more alive and working more effectively in the workplace as well. Yeah. So sometimes it does mean being quite stiffly challenging, but it doesn't mean that it's about that individual being wrong. It's a fact of focus on the behaviour rather than the individual. Yeah, sometimes we can demonise the individual because they just don't fit with the way we see the world. Yeah. But can we do that? Yeah. Yeah, so just a few things about work. Any questions on that? I mean, I think we've covered it a little bit, but how do we bring ourselves more into work?
What I'm getting is that it's very specific to the individual circumstances.
It is, yeah.
Sort of seems to be there. But it is also a real tension that I actually get quite often. So I do both at work. I sort of work ethically and I try and engage with people rather than the task, which helps me a lot. And then also I work 4 days a week rather than 5, which also helps a lot. So I'm sort of changing condition, trying to
I wonder whether sometimes we just have to hold it as a question for ourselves and keep coming back to it. Sometimes it's like we think that an answer to a particular question should be immediately apparent because we've asked it. And actually, a lot of the time, what we need is to hold the question in mind, weigh up the particular conditions, and keep just coming back to it with a sense of interest and engagement, and allow enough space for the response to percolate up, as it were. So particular, you know, do I need to change the conditions or do I need to focus on particular behaviours? It's not always clear. It's just not always clear. And sometimes we need to give it time to resolve and to become clear. And in the meantime, work with ethics to make sure that we're not adding to the problem, as it were. Yeah?
I think what gets forgotten really easily is that there's a role for play at work too. Try and make that not just play, but perhaps ritual as well, I think. I think people are so much happier when there's ritual, and I know what I'm talking about.
So a sense of doing stuff together or collectively.
So much, it just has such a positive effect on people if you recognise them in the context of a ritual, but then I was also thinking about play, but then it's a separate thing. I'm just saying stuff now.
That's fine. I'm going to move us on a little bit. Because there are a number of other calls that pull us away from practice that we can think about. You know, there's the call of family and friends. There's the call, you know, if a lot of us have particular family contexts or caring contexts, or maybe we're parents of children, maybe we have particular sets of friends that... you know, see us in a particular way, in a particular role. And often many of us, when we're working our way into the spiritual life, have particular contexts which we're viewed in a particular way in. I know for me it was my clubbing friends. You know, and I've said this before, and one of the sort of key moments was a friend of mine saying, yes, you can come out with us tonight, but don't wear orange. Which was a sort of comment on the fact that I'd stopped drinking, that I was meditating, I was being kind and not so gobby. And he wanted his old, slightly catty, friendly friend back. Yeah. And I was sort of actively trying not to be that person who cut people down in five sentences. I confess. Sometimes it means, you know, I mean, in a sense, if our friends are real, they'll allow us to grow. Yeah, if that's what friends, from a Buddhist perspective, that's what friends are. They're people that see the potential in you. Yeah? They're people that allow you, and together you gradually work together to realize both of your potentials. And they might be quite different. They might be quite individual to you with particular aspects and talents and emphases, but you might, what's most apparent in friendship in the Buddhist tradition is that sense of responding to the other's potential, really living for that. However, if we have families, or if we're responsible in families, that can take a great deal of our time, can't it? So how can we keep spiritual practice alive in those settings? Any perspectives? Yeah.
Well, at least in my experience, I think it can be quite hard to do that when sometimes the people around you who don't necessarily understand the kind of spiritual path you're on can directly challenge it. And then you tend to become defensive. And as soon as you become defensive, then it all collapses.
Yeah.
So I personally find it hard to have that perspective amongst people who see things differently.
Yeah. And has anybody developed any strategies around that? Any ways of working? What do you normally do?
Yeah. Well, I may find a way to show explicitly the well-being I feel. And that makes them feel a little bit more comfortable. And I may use humour, but that's my own strategy. Just to say, you know, you don't need to take it seriously.
Right.
And that tends to dissolve the tension.
Sure.
Especially, depending on who your friends are at the end of the day, I come from a very Mediterranean Catholic type of background, and the idea of saying Buddhism is really part of the room there, which is fair.
Yeah.
So it's my responsibility to make it less scary, I think, as well.
I think it's quite important to emphasize this as a personal path, and that it's something that we're exploring. But in some way, reassuring people that our exploring is not a critique of them. In a certain way, often people can feel that our efforts are somehow a commentary of some nature on their own lives, and we can just reassure people that that's not the case. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
It's very easy. And sometimes it's about just being in communication about what is it indeed that we're exploring, and what are their responses to it, and again, staying in as open communication as possible. Trying as much as possible to not to polarize, and allowing people to have their criticism, and recognizing what's true and what's not, even. Yes? But sometimes, you know, it's not necessarily a matter of the actual fact that we're on a path. It might just be a matter of time. You know, if we're parents, our children take up an enormous amount of time. And it might be that our practice is patience, forbearance, and a creative engagement with the development of our children, and really committing to that, really, really committing, and seeing the opportunities for bringing more kindness and creative responses to those times when the children just don't want to do what we want them to do. Very difficult. It's a tremendously creative practice. Very, very difficult indeed. And I've never felt I'm mature enough to do it. But in a sense, I have a great deal of admiration for people who creatively engage with parenting. Certainly around from the Buddhist center's perspective, it's about perhaps trying to engage with allowing more family activities. I think that's something that we need to develop around the Buddhist center. There is a monthly Sunday school, but it would be great if that were developing. Perhaps on festival days, making sure we have creches, making sure that we do more family activities. There are family retreats even. Perhaps creating those contexts. And maybe even creating Sangha with other parents in the Sangha. So there's more of a sense of collective practice and the sharing of experience in relation and development of parenting from a Buddhist perspective.
John, you're saying, are you saying then on the retreats, obviously we have the men's retreats, the women's retreats, have we ever had any parents' retreats?
There are family retreats that occasionally run, yes.
And pressures of providers, so the parents can freely well,
you're there with the kids as well, yeah.
Very good, should be developed.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that is a very good, I really welcome what
I think
say.
So, yeah.
Mm. Mm.
But also in those retreats, it's not just that, but the children are looked after, and then the parents go off and meditate and do ritual. So it's more kind of integrated thing where kind of children and parents are kind of together doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's kind of made more fun.
What I was going to say is that it depends how you see practice.
Yeah.
I, as a parent, would say that being a parent is the best example for me of practicing. So
yeah,
I don't
great
see
to hear.
Parenting as taking you away from practice. I actually see it as enhancing practice and a real opportunity because of the love that exists between children and their parents. I think it's a real opportunity to develop practice. So. I sometimes have a problem with the phrasing that is somehow a contradiction or a tension. I think it's a question of the paradigm you enter that in. Because actually I think parenting is probably, from my personal experience, the best opportunity to practice.
Absolutely. But then if you back that up with retreats that support that, you get the chance to top up.
I think that's what I think it's like I think up, it's helpful for the venue of the practice to be more encouraging and accommodating and making that easier. Then I think because of the opportunities within it, so I think I would welcome more family friends in here and other Buddhist countries.
And I think that's something that's emerging slowly. And I think it's an important development. So I'm sorry to say that we need to finish. Really sorry about that. Haven't even covered half of the material. But maybe we'll revisit it next week and I'll be a bit more purposeful. But it's been really very rich hearing people's perspectives. So next week we're going to revisit this nature, the nature of the call to practice, but in some other arenas as well, that we can develop our practice to make sure that we are as much as possible in touch with the call of the Dharma, or resonating and in harmony with it, rather than those contexts taking us away from the Dharma. Okay, so we'll leave it there this week.